This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is July 23rd, 2009. This is the second interview session with Judith Kornblatt, Professor of Slavic Languages and Literature and also Senior Associate Dean of the Graduate School. Judith, we wanted to pick the interview up today with a comprehensive review of your teaching career from the time that you arrived at Madison up to now, how that has changed, what courses you developed, what you liked teaching, what was more onerous. So I guess we should start with, when you were hired, what were you hired to teach?
I was pretty much hired as a generalist. To teach both language and literature, to teach both undergraduate and graduate, to teach both 19th and 20th century, which are up till now the two main centuries of Russian literature. And I started out all over the place as well. Mm-hmm. One of my research specialties is Nikolai Gogol, but there was someone here, Jim Bailey, who had been teaching a Gogol class for many years, and so I didn't move into teaching Gogol right away. It was several years before I taught a Gogol class.
Did you know that when you came?
I knew that when I came, and I was also happy to teach just about anything. I mean, I have a lot of different interests, and the way that the Slavic department works is that we have at least one 900-level graduate seminar, and usually only one 900-level graduate seminar a semester. And so that rotates through the faculty, but when it comes to you, you can do whatever you want. Oh. So that's been a good experience, me being able to explore different areas doing that. Mm-hmm. Also, when I first came, I was asked to develop a course for a special topics rubric and a course to teach in that rubric because they hadn't had that before at the 700 level. So I did that my first year also, teaching a class on literature and journals in the 1920s, which was a formative year, obviously, for formative decade for Soviet literature. It was before socialist realism, after the revolution, and it was quite a bit of variance in that decade, trying to figure out what would be the prominent journals, what would be the prominent stance. And so I developed that special topics course, and after that, from then on in, people in the department could teach a special topics course, again, on whatever they wanted or whatever was needed. And that was a good experience also because I taught several courses in that rubric over time.
Is that typical of departments to have that much freedom?
I find that in our department we have less freedom than in a lot of the bigger departments where they have a lot of lecturers teaching the meat and potatoes courses for the undergraduates. But in my department, in fact, it's faculty who are teaching the meat and potatoes courses. And so it's often only one course a year that you can really sort of experiment with. Whereas in history or in English, they're making up new courses all the time. So although when we could experiment, we could experiment as widely as we wanted to. We didn't need to stay in the area in which we were hired. So if you're in English and you were hired for Victorian literature, basically you have to teach a course in Victorian literature, but I could teach a course in anything, in Russian culture altogether, or comparative. But there was I needed to teach pretty regularly a course that I love teaching, which was the 19th century survey course, literature and translation. For the first time, freshmen, sophomores, in there reading Dostoevsky, their eyes wide, and for the very first time.
You don't mind survey courses.
I love teaching that course. I mean, just talking about questions of good and evil for the very first time for these students, or narrative perspective, opening their eyes in the very beginning I love teaching that. I've also taught. I've taught second and third and fourth year Russian language, our fourth year language course is already really basically a literature and culture course. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy that too. I like teaching undergraduates, and so I haven't had any problem with that. A lot of the other courses that I've taught, Soviet Lit, Women in Russian Literature, then when I started to teach Gogol regularly, those are combined graduate and undergraduate classes in our department. So they're combined with a 200-level literature and translation and a 400-level Russian class. So Russian majors and graduate students will take the 400-level, and the undergraduate non-majors with no Russian will take the 200-level. It's a challenge, it's particularly a challenge when you get native speakers who aren't Russian majors, and they have they might not have the experience in literature, but they have the Russian language, sometimes better, usually better than the Russian majors that we have. So there's can be a little bit of juggling that goes on. Then we meet extra hours to read texts in the original. But I like that too. I like that challenge. I like finding ways to use the graduate students in the class to mentor the undergraduates and give them some kind of give the graduate students experience with undergraduates teaching literature, which they don't all get. So I like it, but it's tough. Those are tough classes.
And I would think that would be very difficult.
Yeah. And but that's so for many, many years I've taught Gogol that way now that I have. So I teach Gogol maybe every 3 years. And I also teach graduate, either at 700 or 900 level. A couple times now I've taught a seminar just on Gogol's novel Dead Souls for graduate students. And that's a lot of fun. They like it a lot. They like to be able to focus just on one text and really learn it thoroughly, learn all the scholarship. And so
when a scholar like you says fun in related to teaching, and you're not the first professor to use that, what does that mean exactly?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, it means something slightly different, I think, with undergraduates and graduate students.
Okay.
I guess I just like talking about this literature. I like teaching in general. I like standing up in front of a bunch of people and talking.
Uh-huh.
And seeing their responses and playing off of their responses. But I just also like talking about the material. And so it gives me an opportunity to, with Gogol, who is a very serious writer, but also a very comic writer, to talk about the things. What is it that makes this particular sentence funny? I just like talking about it. But I also like, as I said, seeing their eyes open wide.
Uh-huh.
I like it gives me pleasure to see them learning how to think in a different way. So for undergraduates, it's just sort of like turning them on. That's fun to turn them on.
Uh-huh.
For graduate students, it's actually more work. I would say probably the fun there comes in seeing how well I can model being a good teacher for them, because this is how they're going to go on and, basically I learned how to be a teacher by not doing many of the things that my professors had done.
Right.
Well, I think there might be a better way to teach people than that. And so that's been just seeing them grow as not just teachers, but also scholars. So this last time that I taught Dead Souls, which was, I can't remember now, I think it must have been last fall, as a seminar, I decided to do it, to not only focus on the content, but also focus on sort of professional development opportunities. So I gave the students the opportunity to do the kinds of writing and the kinds of presenting that they would do as academics. So they had to write, they had to write a book review. Now, it was for a book that had previously, been published. It was for, they each had to choose sort of a standard work in the field. So they weren't having to determine, is this good or not? Because you know, someone else had already determined that, but they had to write it in the format and the tone that they would write a book review in. They had to do peer reviews and at the end of drafts, write the kind of, you know, paragraph that we as professors have to write to help the student write a better draft the next time. And so they had to practice that kind of writing. They had to write an abstract when they presented their, when they decided what their seminar paper was going to be on. They had to write that up as an abstract as though they were presenting it for a conference. Mm-hmm. They had to deliver a conference paper. They had to, when they had to write a draft, and then I and their peers wrote comments and they had to then rewrite. When they did that, they had to write a sort of a cover letter that you would have to write to a journal once you've, if you've been given a submit and rewrite, I mean, resubmit, rewrite and resubmit, whatever it's called. Then you have to write a cover letter saying, yes, I, you know, this was a very good suggestion. I did such and such, but reviewer number two suggested whatever, and I didn't think that it did fit, you know, so that they needed to do that kind of writing also. So I gave them sort of the chance to see the different kinds of work that they would have to do as an academic. So that, and that was fun to just see how they took to that, how they...
Now, I make the assumption in your graduate classes that you assume when you walk in there that you will be challenged and that you will, provocative theses will be
right.
presented to
yes,
you for your
yes.
reaction.
Yes.
Does that ever happen in the undergraduate
Actually,
class?
I walk into my undergraduate classes with that assumption also. And so I, when I grade, I tell them in advance that it's more important that they ask a question that's worthwhile to ask in their paper than they just dot all the I's and cross all the T's. That I don't want a paper that's just repeating back to me all the things that I already know. I already know those things, and mm-hmm. I told them. but it's, you know, they, I do want them to have a well-structured essay and to, you know, have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I do want them to spell check and whatever, but that the asking of the question, figuring out what kind of question to ask is probably the most important thing. So, I grade that way. Sometimes it's hard because you get like this sort of perfectly packaged essay that clearly from a person used to getting all A's, but it's boring and nothing. And I'm thinking, well, can I not give it an A? You know, it does have all of the ingredients. It just is missing that spark. So I'll often give that one an A too. But what might be otherwise a B paper can go up, you know, to an AB or an A minus or whatever by having a really provocative, a provocative question, not just in a provocative approach. I'm not big on, you know, the cutesy introductions where they, you know, a lot of padding and little, you know, curly cues and things. But to actually ask a question about the text or the texts, that makes your reader think is what I give most credit for.
Now, in your first years as teaching, how much are you teaching? What is your load?
When I first started, the load here for all everyone in my department was 3-2. So three courses one semester to the next. I was then part of, as a junior faculty member, a restructuring of our curriculum for the undergraduate curriculum. That allowed us to move down to a 2-2 teaching load.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, after the first year or so, it was 2-2.
And is 2-2 the appropriate level?
Yeah, 2-2 is probably right for humanities programs where you're expected to do research as well.
Judith, how does it work in the department? You know, the academic year is done, or at some point you're planning the schedule for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
How is that, how does that work?
Yeah, it changed over time in a way. And I'm not exactly sure where we are now. We now have a curriculum committee, that I had, or a timetable committee is what we have that I had instituted when I was chair. It was, and it's sort of understood that there's certain courses that sort of belong to certain people, and there are others that rotate. And so we'll say, I'd like to teach such and such next year, but again, they're the meat and potatoes courses that we know we have to cover. We need to have, you know, 19th and 20th century survey. We need to have faculty teaching usually third and fourth year Russian. We need to have at least one, preferably two 400 level courses for our majors. We need to have a seminar. There are certain things that need to be covered. And so we usually make sure those are covered first. We have had a great reduction in our teaching staff over the past 5 or 6 years. And so...
How much of a reduction?
We're building back up again. But Gary Rosenschild retired, and we were not allowed to replace him.
He retired,
and that was part of the LNS budget reduction, where there were permanent reductions. Margaret Beisinger, who taught folklore and Serbo-Croatian, other related courses, she left. Ben Rifkin left, who was our language coordinator in the department and also taught quite a few important courses. He left. Yuri Shigloff died last year. We have hired to replace Yuri, and we've now hired her partner. And that, when Karen comes, that will be a big help for sure. But we were able to hire a lecturer level to temporarily replace Ben Rifkin, but that changed the dynamic of the program quite a bit. Without someone who doing second language acquisition as a, you know, at the faculty level and training the TAs in a particular way. So we've had a lot of adjustments to do. And also, I've been only part-time teaching for now over 10 years. David Bethay only teaches part-time. So it's been, covering the basics has been sort of a major issue. And because we're a department that teaches a number of different languages, we're not interchangeable. You know, so they'll say, well, you've got very low enrollments in Serbo-Croatian, let's say, you know, but he can't teach the Russian class. He speaks Serbian. or Polish is not this or that, but that's, you know, those, they're not interchangeable. And so we might have a number of low enrolled courses. And I constantly argue that that's what we should have. Because if we're not teaching Czech and Serbo-Croatian and Polish, who is? And that's what a university like ours should do. But by nature, they're going to be low enrolled. So, but we're constantly in our department having to argue, you know, why that is and why we still need to hire an extra faculty or extra lecturer in the Russian program. So it's a constant interaction with the dean's office.
Well, that's tactfully. Judith, I don't want to get into your research program just yet, but we are going to be addressing that later. In your first 3 years of teaching, is the amount of energy and attention that requires, does that essentially put a stop to your research?
No. It never has. I've also was for a long time surprised by people who would say, well, I can't get anything done during the academic year and not do any research at all and try to, you know, jam some into 3 weeks in the winter and then over the summer. I was always able to keep something going. And I don't know if that's my work style, my personality. It was partly the support of my department. I guess it was largely my work style because I've always been a multitasker. And so, I would say to myself, even if I'm having to focus on this, these other things are hanging out in my brain anyway. I can't get rid of them. I'd rather do the work on them. You know, I had a colleague who's since left who would, you know, she'd have letters of recommendation to write. And she would just say, I've got to do this now. And she would do whatever it was, you know, often her own research, I guess, you know, for weeks at a time and leave those letters of recommendation on her desk. And sometimes it would get, the deadline would pass. But she said, no, I'm working on this now. I couldn't do that because they were sitting there, they were weighing on me in my brain anyway. Mm-hmm. Better I write those letters of recommendation, get them off, again, model to my graduate students the what I thought was a better, you know, mm-hmm. but that it was important to keep deadlines for students. And then at the same time, try to do some of my work. And so I tell my graduate students also, my dissertators, that if they're writing on a chapter, they should say, okay, mornings, I'm going to write on this chapter. Afternoons, I'm going to go ahead and start reading for my next chapter. And I also tell them, before your defense, already start working on whatever your next project is going to be. Sort of overlap these things. And some people can do it, and some people just can't. But I found that it's much more efficient to sort of keep several things going at the same time. And because when you finish one thing, there's always that lag and that bit of downtime anyway. So if you're already have the momentum going for something else. So I think that's how I work anyway. So I did keep working. I had my, we can go into my research later, but I was preparing new classes, but I started to work on my second project already, my first couple years here. I can't remember exactly, but I also had a child during my first year here. That was more what kept me back than the teaching load. But I think in terms of this fun that I talked about of teaching, uh-huh. it does, although it's exhausting, and I would walk out of every class with laryngitis and just sometimes sweating, it feeds you. It gives you energy also. So, I'd always realize that after I taught, especially if I taught two classes in a row, there was going to be a couple hours where I wasn't going to really be focusing. And so I would do something else, or I would, go to the library to get books out, or I would, start on a letter of recommendation that didn't take the same kind of concentration. So I always gave myself some time to just recover from teaching. But then I would have time to, not only prepare the next class, but also do some research. So.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you, it's sort of a softball question, but it's important because of the position you hold now. Over the past 4 years of interviews that I have done, I have heard a variety of reactions as to the place of teaching in the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been all over the map, moderate, anti, pro. Where do you see teaching in the life of the university?
There's one question, the life of the university, and there's another question, the life of me, but I think the answer is the same for both of them. I think it's really, really, really important.
And valued?
And so how do other people value it? So I value it, do other people value it? I think that there are pockets that don't. I think that my department always has valued it. I sometimes see even in the department some pockets that I won't say who, but a very important professor in our department who is also known as a very good teacher and has a real following both at the undergraduate and the graduate level, he would say, well, it's just an undergraduate course, just get it done. Focus on your graduate courses. And that always surprised me because he clearly was, doing a good job at his undergraduate courses always. In my program, and I think to a large extent in all of the language programs, there's a very healthy respect for teaching. I think that we teach in all of the language programs, and definitely in mine, there's a very strong emphasis on teaching pedagogy to our graduate students, so mm-hmm. teaching them to be teachers and teaching them that this is an important thing. What's harder sometimes for them is learning how to budget their time so that they're not spending all their time preparing their teaching. But learning about new teaching methods. There is support for that in my department, for mm-hmm. sure. Being here in the graduate school, I also see what I see how there are different models throughout the university. And I see that, in fact, teaching means something different. So, you know, I have a friend in chemistry, and I always, you know, tease him because he only teaches one course a semester. And he thinks, oh, that's so much, it's so much, I can't do it. And then he says, well, but I'm teaching my graduate students all the time. And I'm thinking, well, but I'm teaching my graduate students all the time too, but I also have 4 classes a year that I'm when I'm not doing service. So that I see, you know, so that, you know, when he feels that he, you know, in the lab, his dissertators, whatever, that's teaching. And it is teaching. I agree with it. I'm doing that too with my dissertators. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, there's classroom teaching that I think is not just important, but fun, as mm-hmm. I said. So all of the time, I mean, there have been a number of times when people have suggested that I, you know, move on in administration, do full-time administration in one capacity or another, here or somewhere else. And granted, I don't teach very much now, but I think keeping my hand in teaching is one of the things that keeps me grounded personally, and also gives me credibility with the faculty. In the graduate school, they're very good about their associate deans giving them the resources that they need to keep their research up. Because if you're going to be, you know, for the academic associate deans, if you're representing research in that area, so when I was arts and humanities, it was important that I continue to publish and continue to do things so that, you know, I'm judging other people's research. They should feel confident that I'm someone who has the status to judge. So they're very good about providing that opportunity. I think it's also important to continue to work with undergraduates as well as graduate students it's hard to say this, but once you go into administration, and we'll talk about this a lot later, you become they instead of us.
Yes, that's
and
really
so
true,
to the extent to the extent that I could, I wanted to mediate that otherness, that they-ness, mm-hmm. and say, look, I'm still doing this. This is, you know, when people come in to, you know, faculty come in, or when students come in and say, I'm having this problem, that I can say, yeah, well, when I've had that problem, I can do such and such. Or, yeah, just last semester, this issue happened, and, you know, this is how I handled it then. I think that's really important to maintain that, not just that it looks like you have a connection with what the faculty are doing, but really to have a connection with what the faculty are doing and the issues and the problems and things. So, you know, I might be having very rosy glasses, but certainly the world that I come from seems to value teaching. Is it when we write tenure reviews, does it get as much, you know, or when we look at individuals for hiring, faculty for hiring, do we focus as much on the teaching as on the research? Probably not as much.
Does it, however, carry a substantial weight?
It carries a substantial weight. We have made some mistakes with hires, with people who aren't as good teachers as we would want. And then we're playing catch up all the time.
Would you say, Judith, that just based on your tenure here at the university, that the centrality of teaching waxes and wanes, or would you say it's generally at a stasis, that it's...
I think officially it's grown. Certainly what, at least in arts and humanities, where how the divisional committee rates it, or at least the amount of documentation that they require so that presumably they can rate the teaching, has grown exponentially. whether in it, it really has taken on a bigger sense, I don't know. I would say there's probably been a gradual increase in the importance of teaching on campus in arts and humanities.
Now, what about student evaluations of teachers? Is that valid? What's your opinion of those?
I'm glad we do them. I had a colleague in my department who never did it, and it really angered me, and there was no teeth for us to make him do it somehow. I think it's worthwhile stopping and asking questions, but I don't, when it comes down to it, they're not that valuable. Partly because as a faculty member, as a teacher, when you read them, you see only the negative things, you know. Oh my God, you know, this person said such and such, and you forget that five other people said the opposite. So it, you know, I know a lot of people who are just scared every time they have to open them up, not because their scores are low, but because they'll focus on whatever negative comment there was in there. And there are often absolutely competing comments. Best teacher I ever had, worst teacher I ever had. And so then you toss those out, let's say, the two extremes, and in the middle it's just kind of mamby-pamby stuff. Mm-hmm. I have sometimes, but I'm not consistent with it, done some kind of evaluation process in the middle of the semester. But it's hard for the students because they're afraid that whatever they say is going to affect their grade. So it has to be done in a way that makes it very clear that it's really so that I can reassess and maybe even change the syllabus for the second half of the semester, that I can use their, you know, that I have to ask questions in such a way that, and I have to then follow up on it to show that I really did listen to what they said. That has to do with some very specific things about the class and not just do you like me or not. Mm-hmm. So the end of the semester ones aren't, I don't think, all that valuable, except the process of doing them is important, to have the students sit down and, to the extent that they do, rethink the semester and how it went is important. Has it changed how I teach? I don't think in major ways. You know, every so often I'll hear, you know, teacher didn't, you know, someone will write, didn't give, you know, me the opportunity to say what my opinion was. And I'm look back at that, and I, the way I look at myself is I'm constantly giving them opportunities to say what their opinion is. And I'm, so then I do think, well, what impression did I give that, you know, only my opinion was right? And so I'll think about that. But since I'm pretty convinced that I've set up the class in such a way to give them every opportunity to let me know what they think, I don't know how to, you know, it doesn't give me specifics in how to change it. So that's my feeling about it. And certainly to, I mean, the number scales are cuckoo. And to base tenure or base merit or base, you know, post-tenure review just on that is odd. And then when I, you know, when I would be putting together nominations for teaching awards or whatever, I could always pick out the, you know, I knew what kinds of comments were the ones to pick out, you know, like, you know, most creative or whatever, and you can find them in anyone's file. If they had asked me to find the negative ones, I could have found those too. So it's not the best way, I don't know, but it's better than nothing, I guess, is what I would ultimately say.
Really? So you would assign some utility to it?
Just to do it, and whether it looks like, you know, that it looks like there's accountability is important. But then, of course, those people who really need to be held accountable are the ones who don't either hand out the evaluations or read them.
Is it your choice as a professor?
No, you're supposed to hand them out. Uh-huh. It's certainly your choice to read them or not.
But you're required to put them out,
right?
And somebody presumably
looks at them. But again, there was this faculty member in my department who never did it, and you know, what were we going to do? You know,
Judith, when I looked at your resume, You taught a lot of courses that were cross-listed.
Yes.
Women's studies.
Yes.
Jewish studies.
Yes.
And I can't remember what
religious studies, religious. Global studies. Yeah.
How does that work, and was that satisfying?
Yes, that because I am very cross-disciplinary in my approach and in the content that I study, mm-hmm. And also in terms of bringing in other students, I liked the same way that I like to have the, you know, teach that undergraduate survey class. Mm-hmm. So for the first time, I'm teaching them these kinds of things. If you bring in a history student, I have to be cognizant, you know, whereas most of the students are literature students, I have to be cognizant of that, that the person is coming from a different place, and it makes it more layered, it makes my teaching more layered, it makes my thinking about how I prepare my class more layered. So I like bringing in students from who have themselves different, have been taught different methodologies, different approaches, or have read different kinds of things. So I like that. I have a when I first taught a women's studies class, cross-listed with women's studies, I was participating in a faculty seminar, informal faculty seminar, on teaching, on feminist teaching or something. Not teaching about feminism, but a different approach. Somehow, could we teach differently? Mm-hmm. And I remembered actually when I taught at Williams, I was participating in also something like this, and we did have. Our discussions had an effect in changing the course evaluations because some of the questions in it had been, you know, is your instructor, you know, an expert in the field or something like that, which really reified a very old-fashioned, quote-unquote masculine approach to standing in front of the class and pontificating and passing on information to the unwashed masses. Mm-hmm. And whereas there are other ways of teaching where you're more on the same level with the person and you're, you know, you encourage discussion and you're not the great expert and simply there to hand out information. Mm-hmm. And so we realized that the evaluations themselves were teaching students what was supposed to be the best kind of teaching, and that if we changed the way the evaluation was written to see did your instructor encourage discussion, let's say, that would then, you know, women might get better grades, mm-hmm. than they had been because they were teaching differently. So I was aware of this, and I was involved in this seminar, and one of the women talked about what she called terrorists in the classroom, which were students who sort of monopolize the discussion and pull it in the direction that they want to go and intimidate the other students, so the other students don't really participate, and in fact intimidate the teacher as well. So I taught this, so with this in mind, I was teaching a course on women in Russian literature that was cross-listed with women's studies, and I'm looking around, and indeed I realized I did have two terrorists in my class. Both of them were the women's studies majors. and I'm constantly then in this wrestling, you know, competition with them to wrest back control of the discussion. So that was quite amusing to me. But nonetheless, it was great to have them along with some Russian majors and some other people who just thought, oh, it'll be, you know, some engineering students who thought, oh, this might be an interesting class. So I definitely like the cross listing, and I'm involved and remain involved in some of these other centers. It's difficult because service becomes very difficult because you're expected to do service in all of these. So, you know, Jewish studies and Center for Russia, East Europe and Central Asia, religious studies. Mm-hmm. I was in the Lubar Institute, and each of those I care about. And I think it's important. And actually, early on, this is something I hadn't talked about. You might have asked it last time about being a woman in academia.
You want to talk to that at some point.
And I did feel a responsibility often when I saw that I was going to be the only woman on the committee to join, to be willing to, you know, when I was asked to join, to say yes, and also then to speak up and be a major player on it. So I did feel that, only also realized that then the women in the university were being asked to do a lot more service than the men, precisely in order to get a better gender mix. And so I was doing more because of that. But I did think that that was, I did think that was important. So that grows out of being in these interdisciplinary communities also, and feeling like I should be an active member in them. And then obviously you get pulled in a lot of different directions.
Now, where does the initiation for cross-listing come? From you, or from women's studies or Jewish studies or Slavic or Russian?
It can come different ways. I mean, so it often would come from me, because Slavic often needs to increase the number of students. It's a very specialized department, and so we're looking for ways to bring in other students. But, you know, when I was early on, when religious studies was being reactivated, it had been kind of a sleepy little program, and now it's very active. Religious studies, the steering committee went around soliciting cross-listed courses, because they needed to increase the number, not the number of students, but the number of courses that they had in order to be able to have a, you know, a certificate and then a major. And so it can happen in any direction. And a lot of the things that I teach just naturally cross areas.
Mm-hmm. A question okay. about that, and then move on.
Okay.
This process of cross-listing, you made a reference to Slavic languages and studies was always looking for ways to raise its profile. Is that typical across the university for some of the smaller departments?
Yes. Many of the smaller departments have a big, you know, blowout course. So Scandinavian studies, I think, has a mythology course, or classics has the same kind of thing that can bring in maybe, you know, 200, 300 students. Harold Scheub in African languages and literature. So most of their courses, like ours, are low enrollment courses until Arabic became so big, and now they've totally gone out of control. But, you know, if you're teaching, you know, Hausa, or you're teaching, you know, Yoruba or something, it's going to be a small class. But they always had Harold Scheub's African Storyteller course that would bring in the, you know, the students. Our survey courses were never quite that big. I mean, they, you know, they would get up to 150 sometimes. Recently, a member of our department who teaches Serbo-Croatian, and those courses are particularly low enrolled, developed a course on the vampire. And we have discovered that that brings him in. And actually, I was thinking that if he's on sabbatical sometime, I might want to try to, I love vampires, I might want to try to teach that course. He does it with film and with reading.
What a clever idea and, to reach people.
Yeah. So, and in fact, you know, the content can be anything. What we're teaching them is ways to think and
right.
ways to write, and expanding, you know, their cultural knowledge and things. But, you know, I thought, you know, I wrote a book on the Cossacks. You know, maybe I should teach a course on rape and pillage or something and see if that brings people in. You know, sex usually brings people in. So, so many of these smaller departments have a course like that.
Uh-huh.
Each department has its own enrollment problems, actually. So, and sometimes, you know, Spanish can't get enough TAs to teach its, you know, first and second and third year Spanish classes. So they have their own problems with too many students. But that what happens is then their graduate students are so consumed with teaching, because a lot of them are teaching 2-3 sections, they're not able to take enough graduate classes.
Yes.
So each one has its own problem, but we certainly were always looking for ways. And an innovation that I did do, because you did ask earlier about courses that I had
developed.
Developed. I'll talk about the content development after I talk about this. When COMB was just coming on, the COMB requirement, the idea was that these would be small sort of sophomore seminars, faculty taught, 15 students each. Well, it quickly became clear that we didn't have the capacity for that. And I got in very quickly on the bandwagon. I don't know if I was chair then or associate chair or something, and proposed that we would have COMB sections in this survey class, both the 19th and the 20th century survey class. And so the students could still sign up for 3 credits and come to the, you know, 3-day-a-week lectures and still have, you know, have the exams and whatever. Mm-hmm. Or they could sign up for 4 credits and have a 4th hour with a TA where they focus on writing. And they agreed because they couldn't offer enough COMB classes, and they were all of a sudden requiring it of students. And so this was early on. Now on that model, they have many more classes. But at that time, it was unique. And it was very special for us because our graduate students were getting a lot of experience teaching language and 0 experience teaching literature. And so we then were able to have 2 or 3 students a semester also having an experience teaching reading and writing courses. And so it was a wonderful boon for our department, for our graduate students, and also we brought in many more students who took, you know, because they come into SOAR. First of all, the literature classes they had in high school were all called English. Right, regardless of what they read, and so they come. So they come to college and figure they need to take an English class, right?
Yes.
So you wonder why the English classes are so filled up, and it takes a special advisor at SOAR to say no. Any literature and translation class where there are many people in English. I mean, not to speak bad of my colleagues, but colleagues in the English department who don't fathom that, in fact, my training in literature is equal to their training in literature. That what I'm teaching is a literature class with as much sophistication, only more so because I'm doing it in a foreign language. They didn't have to learn a foreign language. But there's this sense that it's somehow different. So
does that extend to the other literature
departments? Yes.
Spanish, French,
Africa? Yes. And so we've been in the Slavic department very active in creating literature and translation classes so that at least we have that there and the students can filter into them. But most of the students come and take English. They think that's what it is. But in high school, they read, you know, Madame Bovary, and they read, you know, some Japanese literature, and they read Crime and Punishment or Notes from Underground or something. It had never occurred to them or to their high school teachers that this wasn't English. It happened to have been translated into English, but that, those kinds of things as a department, we and other departments like us, like ours, are always battling.
How interesting. Judith, I remember now the other question I wanted to ask you. In those survey courses in Slavic languages and literature, did you draw undergraduates from across the spectrum, or were these already kids who were self-selecting?
Well, actually, they were self-selecting because this was an odd thing to take, right? They could have taken English, whatever it was. Or some take Comp Lit because they think that's also the... So that those are the 2 sort of big courses for students who need to fulfill a literature requirement. And so it was already self-taught, and when I was self-selecting, when I would say, why are you taking that course? Most people would say, I needed to fulfill a requirement, and this one looked interesting. But certainly those ones who found it interesting were from all over campus, engineering students and, dairy science students and students who were going into education. So it wasn't only students who wanted to go on in Russian by any means. And some of them had had a, you know, some Russian, you know, had realized that the author they were reading was Dostoevsky and that he was a Russian, and that they took this course because in high school they just loved that, or they had a teacher who loved that. But many, many people, and I always ask, in the large survey classes, I ask in writing. I developed a system that was partly just to take attendance, because if you have 150 people, you're spending 20 minutes taking attendance, and we have to write down how many students are there for the first 2 weeks of our classes. We're told that we need to keep a log of how many students are in the classroom each class period. And really? I also wanted the students to know that they were accountable for being there, because in a large class, so I would do it most Mondays. I would have what I called a quiz. Throughout the semester, usually the first question was a very factual question about the reading. Something, if they'd read the reading to the end, they could answer it, like, you know, who did Joe Schmo marry or something. And the second one was a more interpretive question based on my lectures from the previous week. So the first one, the answer to the first one could tell me just if they'd read the, if they're keeping up with the reading, and the answer to the second one could tell me whether they had been in class the week before and thought about it. So I and a couple of my colleagues have taken up that, but it also just allows me to keep attendance, or make them think I'm keeping attendance, so that they know that they're accountable to come and to pay attention. But in the beginning of the class, I would often ask, why are you taking this class? You know, so we hadn't had a week of lectures yet, so I would ask on that quiz, why are you taking this class? And so even in big classes, I would get feedback on that. And many, many of them are taking it because they have to fulfill a literature requirement, and this one looked like it could be interesting, or they'd once read Brothers Karamazov, or they, mm-hmm. you know, had, you know, they'd heard about Anna Karenina or something. Mm-hmm. So it's self-selecting in that way, but it's still people just doing requirements.
So I would guess that that's kind of a perk of teaching in a big university. Here you are, yeah. an educated scholar, and you've got a couple kids from Cal's.
Right.
You have
right.
someone from the business school, plus you have...
Right. And I think it's a perk. I can imagine that there's some people who don't think it's a perk, who only want to teach in their own specialty to people who are specialized. But for me, it broadens my view of things quite a bit. So that was the answer to that.
So, again, let's say I'm pre-engineering, and I take the survey course. Is there another course I can take, not because I'm going to change from engineering, mm-hmm. but, gee, that was really interesting.
Yes, yes. And actually, we have often felt that the survey classes and other literature and translation classes we teach can bring in students for our language program, and not only vice versa. I mean, the language program students take it, but this way they'll say, wow, this is really neat. I wish I could learn Russian. The problem is at that point, then it's too late to become a major. If you don't start till your sophomore year, it's a rare student who can actually get enough Russian language ability. But we do see that happening, and we certainly hope that happens. And so we always make a pitch for Russian language and other Slavic language classes in the big survey classes and in the lit trans classes, and also other lit trans classes. And there are students, you know, I mean, there have been students, I don't want to claim that every semester I have this, but there's students who say, you know, what are you teaching next semester? I really want to take another course with you.
Right, yeah. I was going to ask that. If there are groupies is not the appropriate term, but I liked mm-hmm. your 101 course, what are you teaching
right,
next?
Right. Yes, definitely that happens. Now, because I don't teach that frequently now, it's been a little bit harder to groom my groupies. But but yeah, that happens, and that's always really rewarding.
Now, you were talking about native Russian speakers. I seem to recall, at least at one point in Madison, maybe in the 1980s, early 1990s, there was an influx of Russian Jews. Soviet Union must have, I've kind of forgotten the dynamic, but
right.
that there was.
Right. Correct.
Did that affect your department? Were you aware of that
Absolutely.
In migration?
Absolutely. And it created extra complexities. There's a distinction between a native speaker and a heritage speaker, and we have both. A native speaker, we usually feel, went at least through high school in the target language, in the original language. Uh-huh. So, and not only in terms of the language, but also in terms of the culturalization. When that kind of a student comes, that poses some issues. But the heritage students, those are native speakers, but the heritage students pose even more problems because they maybe spoke Russian at home but never really learned to read it or write it or didn't really learn grammar. And so you have to put them back. I mean, to learn to write, you need to go back to Russian 101. So sometimes we can put them in just for the first 2 weeks, and then they go into a higher level. But if they don't know the grammar, they just know that it sounds right. So it's very intimidating for the other students in the class because these people sound like native speakers, and yet you need to sometimes undo bad grammar and teach it. So we're trying. We don't have enough students. We're sort of on the margin of enough students, but not really over the margin yet to have special classes for the heritage and the native speakers. And to work, because there's different pedagogical techniques to deal with them. And certainly by fourth year, they need something different altogether. Mm-hmm. So we do have a heritage student or a native student, I think it's called a native student track, where they don't need to take, you know, the courses, the language courses that are required for the major. But it's not, we haven't hit the right button yet. It's we're still playing with that.
Interesting. Does that extend, say, perhaps over in Spanish as well?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when
But they have enough students to do that, to have sort of. Although there's a different thing in Spanish because it's, I don't want to call it an easier language, but one can achieve fluency more quickly in Spanish.
Uh-huh.
And so you have students already by the third year who are pretty fluent, whereas in Russian, they're not. And so you can, you know, mix then by third year the native speakers and the students who had the native English speakers. In Russian, it's more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, in Spanish, they have different tracks, and they have classes for, like Spanish for Romance language speakers. So if you're a French speaker, they have a special class to take in Spanish. And I think vice versa in French also, because you'll learn it more quickly, but you have your own particular problems with it. So, but we're small enough that we don't have enough clientele to differentiate as much as we probably need to.
Was there a drop in interest in Slavic studies when the Soviet Union collapsed?
That's the right word. yes, absolutely. The 90s were a very difficult time for everyone throughout the country. At first, we thought, oh, this is going to be great, you know, opening up the doors, and all these students are going to want to go into business and whatever. But because it was a very difficult time in the former Soviet Union as well, even, you know, study abroad programs, parents didn't want to send their kids over there, and there was a real precipitous drop. It's now built back up again, but it was a very difficult time.
Did that mean that South Hall looked more closely
Definitely. And it's a snowball effect, because the fewer undergraduates you have, the fewer TA positions you have, the fewer graduate students you can support, the fewer graduate students you can support, the fewer graduate students in your graduate classes. So it's a, and then the fewer graduate students, the more faculty might teach courses that otherwise graduate students would teach or lecturers would teach, and then that means the fewer specialized classes that they're teaching. So it's all a big mess. Before we go on, I did want to talk about just a couple of the courses that I had developed. Because we did have, there were a number of things where I participated in trying to standardize some of the meat and potatoes classes, the mm-hmm. third year class, the fourth year class, to at least when different faculty taught them that there would be some general core. So I worked on that and sort of standardizing also the survey course, because when the graduate students come in, they can pass along, when they're TAing, they can pass along their materials from previous year's mm-hmm. students. But if it's a new faculty member comes in and teaches a totally different syllabus and, totally different assessment structure and everything, that's hard. So I tried to get some kind of a continuity there, but that's different than totally new courses. So Gary Rosenshield and I together developed two courses, one on the Jew in Russian literature and one on the image of the Jew in Eastern European culture. And with that, a couple other people also helped us. I actually never ended up teaching them. They sort of became his classes because at the same time I was teaching less and less. I would go into his class and sort of guest teach some of it, but that was fun to develop, to think through what would be good to go into those classes. The class that I'm teaching this coming year, and I only teach one course a year now, I've only taught once before, and that was already, maybe even 7 years ago, a long time ago, that I developed called Russian Orthodoxy and Eastern Christianity. And I had always wanted to do a course like that. It's a 300-level course, so undergraduate. It's mostly undergraduate, but a graduate student can get credit for it, graduate credit. And this was when religious studies, remember I said religious studies was looking to get a lot of cross-listed mm-hmm. courses, and they didn't have anything in Eastern. I'm the only one in the, there aren't many people in the country who teach it, actually, but certainly at this university. And I was able to get a grant from Global Studies to develop it. And that was just a lot of fun. It was a totally different kind of a class. I'm used to teaching text-based literature classes, although I do teach also, at the graduate level, I teach a Russian religious philosophy class. But those are still texts there. And this was, I would say to my history colleagues, what do you do when you don't have they've read the reading assignment, but what do I do in class? I didn't know how, without the text in front of me, to analyzing the text, I didn't know what to do. So that was a very interesting way to learn sort of how to teach differently.
And that's virgin territory,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I was sitting here thinking, gee, that does sound kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I got a lot of different students in it, and just the different perspectives that they brought to it was really interesting. So although I'm feeling like I almost have to re-prepare the whole class from scratch because it's been so long since I taught it, and I developed a website for it and all these, an icon gallery. I'm going to have to, and now that technology is all outdated, I'm going to have to redo stuff. But I'm looking forward to doing that.
Now, Judith, the course that you developed on the Jew in Eastern European literature, mm-hmm. was that at the instigation or a result of the creation of the Center for Jewish Studies? Or was this an independent interest?
Well, it was an interest, and both Gary Rosenshield and I had that interest. But yes, it was, they were also needing to increase the number of courses that they could offer for students to major. So it was related to that.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any courses that you taught that were difficult for you and that you didn't particularly like doing them?
Sometimes I got bored partway through the semester in some of my courses. I don't know. I like teaching, so I'm not uh-huh. sure that I'm going to be able to come up with them so much. There are times when you just get a bad mix of students. I have had actually some 700, 900 level graduate courses like that, where you just kind of get a bunch of blobby, not particularly creative students, and it's like pulling teeth. I have had some of those.
Uh-huh.
At the undergraduate level, I've had classes with difficult students in them, so I didn't always look forward to, you know, every class going in there, but not for the whole thing that I can remember. Maybe I blocked them out.
Yeah, could be. Is it, as we get ready to leave this area of teaching, it's fair for me to think, when I think about who you are, that you are a committed teacher.
But I think that's fair.
and that is part of your intellectual life at this university.
Yes, I would definitely say that. And not 100% unrelated to my research. I mean, I don't feel like I've got this teaching responsibility. And then, you know, I feel that they feed on each other in ways.
Do that.
Okay, all right.
Judith, I want to ask you to turn your attention now to your research program. Again, what it was when you came here and how it has developed over your time period here.
I mentioned early on that I was fortunate to have a postdoctoral year after my PhD, and so I was able then to take my dissertation, which was on the Cossack hero in Russian literature, and really add, not just turn it into a book by sort of changing the tone, but add really 2.5 totally new chapters to it. So I was able to do that before I came here, as a matter of fact, before even I went to my 1 year in Indiana. So that year in Indiana, I was able to start shopping around the book. And that was very helpful because just that takes time and energy. And actually, it was at Indiana University Press, and the editor was the editor-in-chief was very, very positive about it, was promoting it, and at the very end, the faculty committee didn't accept it, saying it wasn't cutting edge. And then I saw the book that they did publish in Russian literature that year, and I'm thinking, that book's cutting edge. But that was quite disappointing to me. And I came here without a publisher for it yet, but pretty well finished manuscript. And again, David Bethea's, my mentor, was very helpful with me in shopping it around, and I ended up publishing it here at UW. And they did a very good job on it. I was already sort of changing research interests, although I remained interested in Gogol, and Gogol wrote about Cossacks and was a major part of that book. It wasn't only about Gogol, but I continued to publish and give papers on Gogol, and also some on Isaac Babel, who was a 20th century writer, Jewish writer, who also wrote about the Cossacks. And so I never wanted to teach a course just on the Cossacks, because I felt like, well, I've sort of explored that to as far as I thought I could explore it. But I kept on working on those authors, not only about their Cossacks, but other parts of them. I think, I can't remember now if I'd mentioned this last time we spoke, that I had been interested in writing my dissertation on something totally different, on Russian religious philosophy, and one particular Russian religious philosopher, Vladimir Solovyov.
Yes, you did mention that. We didn't pursue it.
And I remained interested in Solovyov, even though I didn't write my dissertation on it for reasons. I mean, I didn't feel adequate to write it. I had been hoping when I went to the Soviet Union one summer on a fellowship that I would get somehow inspired and know what I wanted to write, you know, what angle to take, and that didn't happen. I realized that the scholars there knew less than I did about him, and so few people in the States knew anything about him. I just didn't feel there was enough to grab onto, and so I actually went back to my master's thesis, which was on Nikolai Gogol's work, Taras Bulba, and it was from that I expanded into this work on the Cossack hero in general through 19th and 20th century literature. But I was always still interested in this religious aspect. And was able then to read some of the other authors. My minor was in Eastern Christianity, and so I had taken a number of courses and done a lot of reading in church history, in liturgy, iconography, and so I was able to read, let's say, get back to the, you know, to Dostoevsky, who one always chooses as the example, and read him in a different way than other American and European scholars had read him, mm-hmm. and then other Soviet scholars had read him as well, and even then other, even 19th century Russian scholars, because they were taking for granted a number of the basic underlying assumptions, because they grew up in that culture also, whereas I was standing here from the, you know, the late 20th century American female, realizing that I had very different assumptions about the world and different values, and that when, you know, Dostoevsky talked about something, it didn't necessarily mean the same thing, even though he used the same word. You know, even mm-hmm. though he used the word community, it maybe meant something very different than when I used the word community, or when, you know, Raskolnikov bows down and kisses the earth. That, you know, what that meant to me from my own experience could be very different, and yet it has very deep cultural and religious background. So I realized that I had something to offer that many other scholars and students of Russian literature didn't have, and I still was very fascinated by Vladimir Solovyov. So as I'm shopping around my manuscript and doing the final revisions, I already had started working again on Solovyov and actually on Russian religious thought altogether. And I got an NEH fellowship. So I had a semester to really, a year. Well, I had a, no, I don't remember how long I had. I ended up actually, over all of these years, not writing that particular book that I had proposed, although I've written lots and lots of articles that are about that. That actually had to do with the interface of Judaism and Jewry and the Russian religious renaissance at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And I've written a lot on that, but I never really actually wrote that book, so I feel a little guilty about it, although I did a lot of scholarship. But in the meantime, I got more and more involved in Solovyov and also in promoting this new field of Russian religious thought, new field for the United States. And so I got together with one of my professors from Columbia, and we got another NEH grant to put on a conference, an international conference, and we did it here and brought people from Europe and from Russia and all over the United States. And it was, it's sort of, we saw it and it turned out to be that way as a kind of launching of a new field. We invited the few people who were working in the area in an interdisciplinary way. So we had a theologian and we had a religion specialist and a historian and literature specialists and anthropologists. So there were a very few number of philosopher of people who did work on these philosophers and on these texts. And we brought them in, and we also brought in as discussants for the panels mostly younger faculty, junior faculty, and graduate students who had shown an interest but hadn't really yet published in this area, as a way to get them involved in the field and move on. And it was it was a beautiful day or week, whatever. The weather was beautiful, the ambience was wonderful, the papers turned out to be very stimulating. It was one of those things that just really, really worked out, and you can't guarantee that'll happen. And so Gustafson and I then published a book, a collected volume on Russian religious thought, that then sort of is still in print and is, you know, not that there's a huge audience for it, but that's a book that people continue to go back to as a kind of base level
Is it
knowledge.
A definitive study?
Well, it's not definitive because it's too big an area to write a definitive thing on. It was on different Russian religious thinkers mm-hmm. and different angles on them. So it was more to show the possibilities and the avenues for growth in the field in an interdisciplinary way. So that was exciting. And I then...
Are you traveling to the Soviet Union much there?
Yes, I would go every 2 or 3 years for different things, for a conference, or some for research, different reasons. Mm-hmm. And so what we then were, we developed, you know, the Russian religious thought mafia, sort of, that we would meet at conferences, and there was, you know, a group of people that were, a growing group of people that was working in this area. And I continued to work on Solovyov, and some of it on the Jews in Solovyov. I have several articles on that. I became very interested in his sort of mystical experiences. He claimed to have had 3 visions of the Divine Sophia. And this was a, you know, this was a well-recognized philosopher who did, you know, legal philosophy and, you know, ethics and aesthetics, and yet he also had this kind of wilder side to him. And it was a period where people were going to seances in the end of the, you know, in the 19th century. You think of, you know, the Victorian, later Victorian writers, and people doing automatic writing. And so it was that time that he would be, could be taken up by that. William James, the Society for Psych Research, both in the States and in England, and he did go, Solovyov went to England, and he actually had a second vision of Divine Sophia in the British Museum.
Did you believe him?
Well, I ultimately said it didn't matter whether I believed him or not, because what I ended up writing about, I left out a book in the middle there we have to come back to, but my latest book on Divine Sophia writes about what I call his, not his visions, but his revisions. Because what's of interest to me as a scholar is how he then went about trying to articulate what he felt to be a real experience. And in the various different genres, in poetry, in philosophical prose, in drama, in short story, he kept trying over and over throughout his entire career to articulate what is this thing called divine wisdom. And so that's what I was interested in, his revisions. Do I think he actually had them? Yeah, whatever a vision is. I mean, I think he had experiences of some kind that were different than eating breakfast. But I don't know, did a woman stand in front of him and talk to him? I certainly am not one to say, but in this book on Divine Sophia, I went back and looked at all of the mystical traditions that he draws on, because he was very erudite. And some of these traditions he knew before he started having the visions, so they might have induced the visions in a way. Others he continued to study afterwards to learn more about it and to learn how other people had expressed this mystical sense or spiritual sense of wisdom. And so I wrote about what he knew about Gnosticism and the Jewish Kabbalah and Neoplatonism and, you know, medieval images of the eternal feminine and Goethe and whatever, because he was well read in all of these areas, and he also wrote about them in a sort of scholarly way, as well as incorporating some of the imagery into how he talked about his visions. So this is all a long answer to do I think he really did have visions. I think he had experiences that meant something to him. But as a scholar, what I can write about is how he then wrote about them.
Okay, very interesting. That was a little self-indulgent on my part. But I did want to hear what you said about that. It's interesting, the intersection between the life of the intellect and the spiritual mysticism.
Right.
And so I was just interested.
Yeah, but I think what it opened up for me is a whole other area of, a period in history that a lot of times we don't write about. So there are people who write about William James and write about sort of the kookier stuff that people were involved in and the, you know, the mediums and the seances and the materializations. But that often is separated from other intellectual trends that were going on at the same time. And I think what I've discovered is they were all mixed together. You know, there were, and I've said about, I guess, when I've talked about Silvio's father, that he could go to the opera on Saturday night and Sunday morning, go to the, you know, Russian Orthodox Church, that those were not competing, you know, Western aesthetic and Eastern spiritual issues. They can be combined in ways that are very interesting.
I think the popular or conventional wisdom is that the Russians are a very spiritual people, or the do they have a great attachment to the land or something? And is this something that fell within your purview?
Yes. I would say that you can meet Russians that are just as crude and crass and material as you might meet, you know, Americans, so that they're not all spiritual. But if you come to take my class on Russian Orthodoxy and Eastern Christianity, I will talk about how different doctrinal issues might be emphasized one way or another in the Eastern Church and in the Western Church. And it is true that the Eastern Church has always been more willing to accept compromise, to reject hierarchy, and to sort of look at a more dynamic relationship, let's say, between the members of the Trinity, that not following on from Augustine and then the medieval scholastic tradition, where it needed to be very carefully delineated, you know, who's above whom and who's under whom. That didn't happen in the East. Other things happened that you might call more mystical, I guess, but really are more ambiguous or willing to entertain opposites at the same time. Now, did that happen because within their souls they are more mystical and spiritual, or were there sort of historical reasons? For one thing, in the East, they largely lost the, or didn't develop a Latin tradition until much, much later. And so a lot of the scholarship that was going on in the West in Latin wasn't known in the East. And as a matter of fact, scholarship in general, there was no scholastic tradition the same way. And so the experience of religion took on a different importance. So the development of icons and the incense and the very visceral experience as opposed to the intellectual experience became more important. Is that more spiritual? Maybe. I wouldn't draw a hierarchy of that. It's just different. And certainly the pre-Christian world in the area that's in the Slavic lands did have a lot of kind of earth worship, mother worship kinds of tendencies. And Christianity came to a largely uneducated population, and it came quite quickly. I mean, the population was just baptized. And so you can imagine that these earlier religious images and beliefs were incorporated into Russian Orthodoxy in a different way than it happened with this very strong Roman Catholic Church in the West that was, you know, continuing to create doctrine, whereas in the Eastern Church, after the Seventh Ecumenical Council, doctrine for the whole church itself was ended. And so there would be local doctrines that could be developed. But so it was a different historical, cultural, political, linguistic development.
When are you teaching this?
In the spring. It's an interesting topic.
Yeah. To me, I know a little bit, but not very much. I would be interested.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome to come. And you can come when you want and not come other times. I'm happy to have people in my class.
Actually, it would be fun to write a paper.
Yeah.
So You know, Judith, I simply can't remember if we touched much on the tenure process in the first session, but it's probably appropriate to at least revisit it now because you're teaching and you're working on the book.
Right.
Clearly, it is involved in your tenure process.
Right. Now, this book that I've been talking about was all written actually since I was in the graduate school, so it's a much later book. What went into my tenure process was the Cossack book and then the work on the Russian religious thought collection and the work I was doing toward the book that never became a book that was supported by the NEH but became a whole series of different articles.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did talk about the difficulties I had because my department put me up in my fourth year here.
That's right, yes.
And the disillusionment I had because what came back from the divisional committee was, well, if it had been your sixth year, you would have surely gone through. So what they were telling me is I had everything that it takes to be promoted to associate professor, but because I'd done it more quickly, they wouldn't give me tenure. And that was a very disillusioning message to get. But I think I also mentioned that I then 2 months after that, had my second child and forgot about it. And the next year, you know, in my fifth year, I did get tenure.
Uh-huh.
And I remember talking about not feeling that kind of anxiety that I know other people do, including, you know, I'm a mentor in the Women's Faculty Mentoring Program, and my current mentee feels a great deal of anxiety about the tenure process. And I didn't. I felt pretty much, I guess, like, I get it.
Now, the mentee that you're working with now, and I hear this a lot from experienced faculty here, that they are somewhat bemused, in a way, by the degree of anxiety that younger faculty feel about the tenure process. And I don't find it patronizing. They seem to feel like, and I'm putting words into their mouth, do your work and you will probably get tenure.
Right. But you come in with, there's a mystique about tenure. You come in knowing about that mystique and you kind of, you play a role. You live that out, whether reality supports it or not, because this mentee has, you know, great publications, wonderful teaching evaluations, has been doing service. You know, I can't see any objective reason why she wouldn't get tenure, but she came in with this thing of tenure. It's this, I remember a friend of mine once saying that tenure really only means something if you don't get it. You know, once you've gotten it, you're just continuing to do the things you've always done, only more so. But there is always this sense. Here, I mean, the percentage of people who get tenure is in the 90s. They're very, you know, the what I tell junior faculty here being in the graduate school is that we have a commitment at University of Wisconsin, first of all, to choose tenurable faculty. So when we go out to look for someone, we're not looking for someone to hire and then discard. We're looking for someone who we think has the potential to be tenurable. So by the very fact that you've been hired here, there's been a committee that thinks that you can get tenure. And then it's our responsibility to provide you with the support that you need in order to get tenure. Financial support, research support, support for teaching, whatever it is, that's the responsibility of us, of your mentor, of your department, the graduate school. And so if you don't get tenure, it's partly our fault. You know, some people just don't deserve tenure, that's true. But maybe that meant we didn't provide the proper support. So in the research committee in the graduate school, when I was the Associate Dean for Arts and Humanities, we talked about that a lot. Is this a point in this person's tenure process where it would really help if we gave that person 2 months summer salary? Does this person really need the travel support to go to Uganda in order to get this archival research? Then it's our responsibility to make sure that that person can get it.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't any objective reason for most of these people to be anxious, but they come in with this sense that tenure is this huge monster standing in front of them and they need to do battle.
Mm-hmm. Now, You made reference to the book that you wrote since you came to the graduate school.
Actually, there are two.
I'm sorry, two?
There are two, yeah.
I have to believe then that that is a marker that you are essentially a researcher or scholar, that you would make that commitment to do that.
Well, I like it. I didn't talk at all about the book that I wrote. I had researched it before I came to the graduate school, and there is I do want to talk about how I ended up coming to the graduate school. We'll do that next time.
Right.
And so that I had a sabbatical, actually the only sabbatical I've ever had, and my husband and I went to, and my kids went to Israel, and I was desperately trying to think up a project that I could do there, as neither a native Hebrew speaker, nor a native Russian speaker, and there were plenty of Russians there. Mm-hmm. And I came up with this project, and it was my foray into sort of sociology and social sciences on Jewish identity based on interviews with Russian Jews who had been baptized in the Orthodox Church in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And so I interviewed people in Moscow, in New York, in Jerusalem, and talked about what that was saying about how they felt about their Jewish identity. So that was very interesting, but it was a whole new area that I had to read, you know, identity, scholarship on identity in anthropology and sociology and political science. I mean, it's endless. So it was very interesting to move into a very different methodological area. And how do you do interviews, and how do you take from those interviews and write about them and make conclusions from them? So that was very interesting. And I had done the research for that, most of the research for that, the semester before I came to the graduate school. And I had written up a kind of a outline, bare bones of it, through that summer. But here I was working in the graduate school, knowing I wanted to finish that book. So that, I think, gave me the impetus to keep to carving out time to keep doing research.
Now, that's a function of curiosity, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, that you're in Israel, you're going there, and so you say to yourself, I'm speculating here, what can I do? What opportunity is here?
Right. Right, and to be willing to go in a wholly different direction was, it took a leap of faith. And I was actually quite anxious before each interview. I felt outside of my comfort zone quite a bit.
Because of the nature of the questions you would be asking?
Partly, and also asking, you know, meeting people I didn't know at all. Because they'd been recommended by someone who recommended someone who recommended someone. Mm-hmm. And having to explain my project, which was a little off, especially for Russian, former Soviets or Soviets, was way off their normal question mode. So I didn't know these people, and how to ask it rather sensitive questions about who they are and why they did. And many of these people had not really talked about, you know, for 20 years why they had been baptized in the church and that period of their lives, and then hadn't reflected yet on why they had changed in the way they had. And I was forcing them to do this. And a number of them then turned around and said they were so thankful to me, they were so happy for having that I made them sort of revisit this part of themselves. Mm-hmm. But it was hard to do that. So it was a period where I certainly was outside of my comfort zone.
What did you learn? I'm curious. What did you learn from
that? Oh, that's another whole, I don't know, I don't think we have time. But I learned a lot. I learned what many of them said over and over again is they never felt so Jewish as after they were baptized in the church. But my conclusion was, part of what I built on from that, is that what happened is that to be Jewish for the first time in their lives had taken on an internal and a positive meaning, whereas up until then, to be Jewish was always externally imposed and negative. You know, mm-hmm. Oh, you're a Jew. You know, it was anti-Semitism. It was quotas. It was a sense of not fitting in or whatever it was.
A burden.
A burden. And then for the first time in their lives, they see this sense of spirituality, you know, and Jesus was a Jew, and that they were walking in those same steps, footsteps, and to be a Jew then and to learn Hebrew and to learn to, you know, read the, you know, Hebrew scriptures was a special privilege, and it made them feel special. So actually the book is called Doubly Chosen, because you speak about the chosen people, and then that book is called these people would see themselves. I mean, it was my terminology. None of them said to me, I feel doubly chosen, but their words brought out this theme of double chosenness. So it was fascinating. So I worked on that. And then in many ways, I started to see how this interest in Sophia and mysticism that I'd been working on, a lot of it was sort of coming together in my mind. And I started to work on this other book that came out just this past winter. So I always found time to do something.
That's a book. Again, this is indulgent, the Divine Sophia.
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to get a copy of that because I think my wife would be interested. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in this intersection of mysticism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So is it out at Borders?
If they don't have it there, they can order it. It's Cornell University Press.
Okay.
And I'm pretty proud of it. And I'm proud of having been able to do it while I've been working in the graduate school. That also makes me feel proud.
I would think, because you've been busy here at the graduate school.
Absolutely.
We won't get into that now. Okay, let me just conclude this. This now concludes the second session with Professor and Associate Dean Judith Kornblatt.